It's game time. This is The Game on News Radio KMAN.
All right, well, I'm excited to have Derek Young along for the ride today from K-State Online because BY, massive news. Massive news. It's been rumored for a long time and I think assumed for a long time. Everybody has talked about it as if it were a certainty, but today we got the official word. And of course, that story that I'm talking about is that Jennifer Lopez and Alex Rodriguez have officially called it quits. They have officially split. Rumored for a long time, everybody thought that to be a certainty, and now today we have the official confirmation of that. Derek, what is your reaction?
It's your time to pounce. You have an opening here. She's going to be on the mend.
That is a great memory there, Derek. My first celebrity crush was J-Lo. I can remember watching the Love Don't Cost a Thing music video. I'm going to have to look that up and see if it's the one that I can remember in my head. But I remember seeing that and being like, wow, well, how about that? All right. So J-Lo, you're right. It is my time to go pounce. I assume she's on Twitter, right? Do you think the DMs are open? Would the DMs be open?
If her DMs are open, I'm assuming she's not getting to all.
Well, I know, but I need some kind of opening here, all right? That's better than nothing. Shoot or shoot. Shoot your shot, right?
Yeah, when I think of Jennifer Lopez, actually the first thing that comes to my mind is the Made in Manhattan movie. Made in Manhattan, I think? Yeah.
I got nothing there. Geely? Wasn't she in Geely with it was who she was married to at the time. Affleck?
Affleck, yeah.
Ben Affleck, I think. She is on Twitter. It's at JLo. She has 45 million followers, and the DMs are not open.
Do you think she will keep the $1 million diamond engagement ring?
You know, she doesn't need that. I don't. If I were JLo, I would not. I don't think she needs that. She should make a big spectacle of like hitting it with a baseball bat or something.
I could see that. That would be. I mean, she's got a roster. You have some competition. If Ben Affleck and Alex Rodriguez are on her roster, then I think it's going to be a pretty competitive environment.
Well, I guess most people could probably use context clues to put in place in their mind what exactly a roster is in this context. Would you care to explain it though to the uninitiated out there? What it is that you mean by a roster?
It's like a lineup. Like she's got multiple interests, perhaps, and if she's picking from a lineup that also has Alex Rodriguez and Ben Affleck, I don't know if I anticipate John Kurtz being on that roster.
Well, I'm glad, Derek. You're beating around the bush here, man. The roster or bench, as I've also heard it.
She's
described.
Out of your league.
Yeah, like, but it's, you know, you have a lineup of romantic partners that you keep on either a roster or a bench, and you know, depending on what the situation calls for, you go find that person. And by the way, I found this out for the first time when I will never forget it. I was probably like 26, and this girl told me, she was like, all right, so like, are we gonna do you want to actually date, or do you want me to just put you on the bench, like keep you on the bench? And I was like,
I've never had a flat out conversation that like that. I've
yeah.
Never.
Yeah. Nope. Conversation was direct like that. And I was like, you know what? I mean, I respect it. I respect the honesty. Of course, I was hoping that everybody got the joke that I laid on very thick there. We also found out today that the news about a penalty-free transfer is now official from the NCAA. So anybody in college athletics, you now get the opportunity to go transfer once during your college career without penalty. So that has been assumed, and that's why the portals have been blowing up in football and basketball, but it did not actually become official until today. I was just reading the piece. Was it Mike Farrell that had the piece that involved Daniel Amaterbebe? But he was also talking about the transfer portal and what it was going to do, and he certainly seemed to be on the side of more harm than good will come from this. Where do you stand as somebody that covers this very intimately?
I think I think it's pretty level, the pros and cons. I do lean, at least unless some adaptations are made or until some adaptations are made, I would lean to it probably doing more harm than good right now, because not that anyone cares, but I think you're making the job of a college football staff, which is already more difficult than an NFL staff, because you don't get to just like draft and go in an order. You recruit your own talent. So it's not like a draft of sorts. So that makes your job all year round, as opposed to the NFL, where, I mean, I've had multiple coaches that have expressed to me before, and now they're in the NFL, so they got their wish, that they couldn't wait until perhaps an NFL offer, because you go from a 12-month job in college football to the NFL, where you really only work for 7 or 8 months and you're golfing the other 3 or 4. So that's how the coaches view it. So I think it does harm in that. I think you're just making a complicated job that much more complicated. In addition to that, I think that you have some players not getting great advice and going into the portal when they probably shouldn't. You can easily make an emotional decision, right? A couple taps on the computer and you're in the portal, and you don't have anything that's making you reconsider or have second thoughts, when sometimes that is probably a process that should take place. So unless there are changes being made, I think you're going to have way more players in it than you probably should. And because of that, I think the supply is definitely already outweighing the demand, which means an unfortunate conclusion to this chapter for some of the players that go in there.
I will just still continue to beat the drum as devil's advocate here and say that I fully understand what some of the cons are. I think right now you're going to see more of that than you will in a couple of years. And I would still stand up here and say, there's going to be a market correction at some point.
Yeah, I agree.
How much of a market correction I think is up for debate, but there's going to be a market correction where kids will start to figure this out, and it will become the norm. And coaches, by the way, also will start to figure this out. You know, I mean, we're hearing Bruce Weber. You know, he was whining essentially about it, I would say, when he came on the air with us. I'm not sure that he would even really dispute that, because he didn't like it. But like, you'll have coaches that embrace it, become the norm in college basketball 5-10 years down the road. Like, everybody who's still in the game will be coaches who are used to it and embrace it. They're not Roy Williams, who's going to say, well, this is the last straw for me, I'm retiring. And like, everybody will have a better idea of how to manage it and deal with it, and just times change. I just think in some ways it's a natural evolution of the sport, and it's not going to be as bad as some of the knee-jerk reaction would be right now over the long term. Short term, will there be some casualties? Absolutely. But I think there will be a correction long term.
I do think that we're in for a market correction at some point. How quickly those adaptations are made, or how quickly that correction is made, is probably up for debate too, or how much of one is made and how much of one is necessary. Like, if is it going to be enough to not have, like you say, as many casualties, because I think you're going to see quite a few casualties, at least in the short term. But I said, like, right now, I think it's doing more harm than good because of what you're talking about. There hasn't been necessarily a market correction, but something that's not going to improve over time, and maybe doesn't matter as much, because I guess they would just be the rest that don't get a spot, would just be future transfers that eventually get a spot. I don't know. But I don't know what the solution is either. But I think it's going to have a trickle-down effect to high school recruits, because I think you're going to see all of these teams, and you're already seeing it, they're going to take more transfers than they necessarily otherwise would have prior to now, right? So if that's the case, less high school recruits are being taken. And there's two problems with that. One, I think you're going to have a situation where not as many kids are getting a free education coming out of high school. And that's unfortunate, although it doesn't seem like people care about that part as much, because I think people care more about putting money in the pockets of some of these kids when they get to college, you know, the pay for play thing, rather than a college education. But you're going to have a lot less kids, I think, getting a free college education right out of high school, because I think this is going to take opportunities away from them on a yearly basis. And the second problem with that also is, you know, these kids haven't understood that this is happening yet, I don't think, or even their mentors that are kind of helping them along. I've said it before in this 2022 cycle. I mean, these college teams are going to take less high school kids because they have less spots because of the pause, but also because they're they're, you know, allocating spots now for transfers in larger numbers than they ever have.
I guess what I would say, and if the argument is like the trickle down goes all the way down to like D2 players on scholarship and stuff like that, and there would be less for like the, you know, kids who are like fringe D2 players, they might not like, okay, maybe if we want to extrapolate it all the way out to there, then there would be some casualty that wouldn't go away. But I would say even for like, you're right, schools will definitely start holding scholarships for transfers and playing the portal as opposed to going out and taking more high school kids. But I would also say, I mean, another thing that we're seeing in vogue, I mean, Kansas just took a kid from wherever the hell Jeff Boshi coaches, I forget, one of the directional Missouris or whatever. Like, even blue bloods in basketball are taking guys from lower levels. So, okay, maybe there's not that opportunity for you to be the 25th guy in the pecking order of a class at Texas Tech or K-State or something like that, and you have to go smaller college or D2 or whatever. Well, now the opportunity is there. You go to that school, you ball out, do it for a year or two, and you can transfer up. So I think some of that opportunity still comes back around on the back end of this.
Yeah, I do. I think so, too. You probably aren't getting as many years as you normally would. I think a problem for me is that the high school recruits don't understand this yet. And when you don't realize that there's going to be less of you taken, sometimes you can be so patient in the recruiting process. I think we're going to see it this year, that you're so patient and you don't realize how exclusive some of these spots are, then you wait so long and that spot's not there. That always happened, but I think that's going to happen in greater numbers this year, because I think some of these kids really want to take these visits, and that's fine, but if they're not quick on the trigger, these spots can be taken in 10 minutes, two phone calls, and you're out of a scholarship. And that's, I think it's going to be more prevalent in this cycle than we've seen before.
Yeah, and there absolutely will be casualties. I'm very sympathetic to that. I'm very empathetic to that. I just spent my sick day earlier this week, thanks to good old Moderna, and not to scare anybody out there, please go get vaccinated. I feel fine now. It's great. But I was watching Last Chance U, the basketball version, and it struck me when at the end they said, hey, they didn't have a 2021 season. This was from the 1920 season. They didn't have They didn't have a 21-22 season. They're not going to. They're not having a season this year. I'm getting all my dates mixed up. And I thought, well, okay, a lot of the kids that came through in the season that we're seeing, I was like, there's at least a handful of them that, like, if that didn't happen and they didn't have that route to go, like the kid that goes to Sacramento State, he's probably not getting that scholarship. Like, I don't know what he does with his life or what happens. Like, there will be kids that suffer those consequences, and that is terribly unfortunate. It is. But, you know, if you're the head of the NCAA, if you are the committee that's deciding this, like, you have to be thinking globally, and unfortunately, that's just a harsh reality that you can't think about everybody individually. You have to think about the greater good long-term here, and that's the decision that was actually made here.
And I think at the end of the day, everyone wanted it to be equitable, and I think that was the driving force behind this legislation, to make it equitable. If a coach can leave and do as he pleases, then a player should be able to as well. And I'm sympathetic to that, and that's why I'm not like a big detractor of this legislation, but I hate the potential that it also can create a scenario where even within the Power Five structure, we're going to see kind of like a minor league and major league. And I understand it's already kind of like that, but like West Virginia's best defensive football player on the defensive side of the ball, he started all the game last year. Yeah, he transferred to Georgia. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen, so I don't want to scare anyone, but that it would be like Deuce Vaughn breaking out last year as a true freshman at Kansas State, and then Texas or Texas A&M coach call him because that's where he's from, and he transfers there. That's, you know, I have great fear that eventually it will morph into that more and more.
I understand that fear completely, and I do think that that's something we probably should have talked about more when it happened. Tyke Smith, I believe, was his name, right? That left West Virginia, their best safety, best defender, and he goes to Georgia. That is something that should get your attention, and I fully get it if you have that concern that at K-State it will just turn into that all the time. Mm-hmm. I would still think, especially a big part of this is going to be this is just such a big, detailed, nuanced discussion. But a big part of this, too, will be name, image, and likeness, and what will schools that are on the lower end of the Power 5 resource-wise be able to do to compete with other schools? Can you create some incentives there still in college football, crazy college towns, where there is, I remind you, enough money to build very good and competitive facilities? Like, can you channel that into being able to entice enough kids to stick around from that? I think there's a lot of discussion to be had there. I think there's a lot to sort out. I just don't view it as an inevitability that it's going to turn into this terrible thing that will completely enhance the haves versus the have-nots. We can have a lot of debate about that, and certainly, like, that's a topic we can do an entire show on, and we probably will as the years come. But the change, regardless of what you want, I quote the great philosopher Laszlo from the Church of Laszlo in Kansas City. He always says, the boulder of progress is rolling, and you can try and stand in the way of a boulder that's rolling down a mountain if you want, and you may be able to slow it down for a little bit, but eventually that thing's just going to roll and keep rolling. And we know where this boulder is going. So it's going to be a reality that everybody will have to deal with, and this was just an official step in that process. All right. We have plenty to talk about when it comes to Bruce Weber and the Wildcats. In fact, like, so much today that I'm looking around, like, we've got probably not enough show to do all of this. But Ishmael Massoud is the latest that K-State has signed. That was made official today. He's a transfer from Wake Forest. We'll see if DY is on board with this and if he thinks K-State clearly upgraded on paper from last year. That's next. Back with Derek Young from K-State Online. Follow him on Twitter at DYoungRivals. Go check out KSO. You would have known about Ishmael Massoud before it actually happened. He is the latest to transfer into K-State. That was made official, as you just heard from Mitch today. Basically an Antonio Gordon replacement here, but a much different kind of player, DY. Somebody that shot 36% from three over his two-year career with the Demon Deacons, averaged 8 points per game this past year. Now, a couple things that stand out. One, he shoots basically the same percentage from the floor overall as he does from three-point range. He takes over 60% of his shots from three, so he's a guy that likes to hang around the perimeter. He's definitely a stretch four, or maybe even a three. I was talking to a buddy of mine, Josh Graham, who does radio in Winston-Salem and is excellent and covered a bunch of Wake Forest games this year. And, like, that was, I mean, he basically gave me the same scouting report that everybody else had on him, like, incredibly streaky shooter and somebody that struggled to defend, and that's why his minutes really went down toward the end of the season with Wake Forest. What is your overall read here on Ishmael Massoud and how well he fits in, DY?
I just like that they are adding guys that can put the ball in the bucket at a higher clip. I think that he is an upgrade over Antonio Gordon. I'm not here to refute that at all. I was never the biggest Antonio Gordon fan, and you know that, of course. I probably, you know, criticized him more than about any other player. He hasn't shown as much of a penchant for rebounding as Antonio Gordon did, but he does have a similar rate on the defensive end, a rebounding rate, maybe not the raw numbers, but rate is pretty similar to Antonio Gordon. So I think it's in his arsenal, but maybe not something that was all that emphasized at Wake Forest, perhaps. So I think it's a clear upgrade over Antonio Gordon, but again, I wasn't the biggest Antonio Gordon fan. I think the biggest difference between the two is Antonio Gordon was supposed to be a shooter and it never really came to fruition. And this guy has shown that he can shoot really only from the 3-point line, which is fine, but he can shoot and has done it at this level already.
He's really intriguing to me. I mean, I found it interesting that, first of all, and shout out to K-State for this, I liked that in the official release that we got about it today, there were multiple quotes, not just from Bruce Weber, but also from Shane Southwell, who was ultimately responsible for recruiting him here. This is a guy that was from Harlem originally, but he was born in Spain, went to Harlem, then to Wake Forest. He had Ivy League offers, so he's an incredibly intelligent guy. Definitely plays the game in a new school kind of way from beyond the arc with what it is that he wants to do with shooting the ball. Has a 31-point game. Like, it's very intriguing to me, and I think if nothing else, this basketball season upcoming is going to be immensely more intriguing than what we've seen the past 2 years, and certainly this past year, where everybody just said, yeah, they'll be last in the Big 12, okay, yep, uh-huh. And you weren't very excited or intrigued by anything going on here. But, like, look at what the roster – I mean, they have Massoud. I just rattled off everything that's very intriguing about him. there are storylines abound there if you're going to talk about, like, what's going on at the four. What does this mean for Montavious Murphy's future? How exactly does Logan Landers fit into all of this? But, man, you look at the rest of the team, like, Mark Smith is a guy that they've chased for, like, 5 years now. They finally have him here on a roster, and he has all this experience. What can they do with him? Marquise Noel is like this, you know, Steph Curry, I'm just going to shoot it from the logo kind of a guy, which Bruce Weber has never had anything close to that at all.
And he's like 5'6".
Yeah, tiny guy. And then, like, we're not even talking about, like, Nigel, Davion, and Selton and the development there and, like, what happens with that. And then mix in a little bit of, like, okay, how does Bruce Weber manage all of this with a lot of guys who are used to getting plenty of opportunities and plenty of shots? Like, it's going to be a really intriguing, fun season, I think. Maybe fun, we'll see. I guess it depends on how much they win, but it will be much more entertaining than what last year was.
Yeah, I think it certainly is going to provide at least much more intrigue in the offseason, a little bit of a mystery as to how all these pieces are going to blend together. But it's intriguing. It's an exciting offseason that provides a little bit more, you know, I guess hope and optimism is the word still. But I think that there's at least they did some things that you can at least sprint and see in NCAA tournament. So I guess I'm on the lower bar end of the spectrum when it comes to the debate of what next year's outlook is going to be. I still see any NCAA tournament bid as a little bit of a steep hill to climb, so to speak. And it's not something that I would project, but they do have some interesting pieces. It's going to be fun to watch to see how they blend together, if they do at all. And you talked about the storylines abound for that group. I mean, we also didn't touch on, you know, the additions of Mark Smith and Marquise Noel and what that could possibly mean, and Ishmael Masood, and what that could possibly mean for Selton Miguel's minutes. I assume that you're still going to find a healthy dose of minutes for someone that could perhaps be your best on-ball defender of the entire roster, but it could be tricky to do, of course. And if someone's going to have a much more, I guess I want to say, less prominent role than what they are expecting. And you wonder, could that be Mike McGurl too? Because, you know, being a ball dominant or lead offensive playmaker is not really in his DNA. They force fed that to his role last year and it didn't go so well and he wasn't efficient. And Nigel Pack's going to command more of the offense. There are just a lot of storylines, but I'll be intrigued to see just how much small ball they play now, because now maybe they don't, because they have Ishmael Masood.
Yeah, although, so I guess what I was getting at, I got a little sidetracked here. What my buddy Josh had told me is that Masood, he really said, is a more natural three than anything else, and he was having to play basically the five at Wake Forest. He was being played somewhat out of position there and, again, struggled defending at that level. But, like, the way that he plays, and he can put it on the floor. If you watch some highlights of him, it's not like it's not like he's just a spot-up shooter. So I think they can even mix and match some of that. Like, I guess I would just say I don't know that if Masood plays, it necessarily means, like, you have to go big. I think there's a lot of creativity and flexibility there. Now, whether or not, like, he has the chops to cut it and be good enough defending when they're already giving up a lot of defense with the swaps that they've made in the portal this year, questions still that remain to be answered. But I guess that's why I'm just very intrigued, because I think there's so much that you can do with all of this here.
Yeah, no, I would agree, but you're not going to play Masood at the five. We've already talked about that's what kind of took him out of what he's good at, you know, last year. So he's going to play at least the three or the four. My thing is, if he's playing, then one of Selton, Nigel, or Mike McGurl is not. So, or they could play all three of them with him, but then you're taking out Mark Smith, who I expect to start. So that's what I'm saying. Someone's going to get their minutes cut more than they think, and I don't know who it's going to be yet.
Which will be a problem that Bruce Weber has to manage. And I think that evolution is fascinating, because, like, we've seen it blow up in Bruce's face once before when it was really just one guy who was really ball dominant and the star player and got an ego, and things got out of control with Marcus Foster, and that just festered through the entire locker room. We also just have not seen Bruce have to deal with bringing in this much new that includes transfers and guys that are used to playing. We've seen him blow it up twice and bring in like this much new last year, for example, of just players, period, but not players that have experience and are used to getting minutes. So honestly, like, we don't really know how exactly Bruce is going to react to that. But I guess I in closing here, you know, if we're talking about what the expectation is for the actual team next year, six top 150 players with a seventh in Luke Kasubke, who was in the top 150 for most of his recruitment and then fell out at the very end. I mean, that absolutely should be a tournament team. I think it's a question of how the pieces fit together, how do the guys develop from last year, but they have certainly enough raw talent to be a tournament team next year. I'm not predicting that at all. In fact, I won't when we talk about this in the second hour of the show, but there's enough talent there for them to be a tournament team.
Yeah, I would agree, especially with the way they closed out the season, right? They give people some hope for this upcoming season, and I understand that. Here's my thing that I think is a fair concern, and I think you've touched on it just briefly already, is the reason why they finished the way they did this past year, which was, you know, basically a complete 180 from the team that we saw for, you know, almost 80% of the year, is the way they turned it up on defense. Well, one of those reasons why they turned it up on defense was Dejuan Gordon. He's no longer here. You can, you know, have your criticisms about Dejuan Gordon, but he gave them some length, and he wasn't great off the ball as a defender, but he was still good on the ball. And they still have their best on the ball defender probably in Celso Miguel, but you're adding, you know, transfers, they're going to play considerable minutes. And I think all three of them, you know, have big questions on the defensive side. I think, you know, the one criticism for Mark Smith throughout his career is he's not the most athletic and not a great defender, a willing defender, but not a great defender because of his athleticism limitations. So that's been the one bugaboo with his career. Marquise Noel is actually a pretty good defender, but you can only do so much when you're 5'7". And you already touched on it. Ishmael Massoud was criticized for his defensive, although he's probably defending out of position, but he was, you know, wasn't great on that end at Wake Forest. So it's interesting that I think defense is probably what brought them back to life a little bit at the end of last year. And it's quite possible they take a step back in that department once again this year.
Yeah, well, I think it's inevitable that they'll take a step back defensively because what they've added is much more offense than defense, but they also proved that they could coach it into a team. So if you have some veterans, does that catch on quicker? And I think these are all the – I could just keep going. I think it – I am just glad as a talk show host, a media member, like somebody that covers the team that we have, there's just a lot more meat on the bone this year than there was last year for the team coming up. Derek Young will stick with us here as we move on in the first hour of the show. Let's talk some Shane Southwell coming up next because he's been responsible for three of the five that K-State's pulled in here, if you're talking portal and then just high school signees. And Rob Cassidy, our old friend, had a tweet really painting Shane Southwell in a very positive light earlier this week. We'll see what D.Y. thinks coming up next. Derek Young hanging out, the Young Rivals on Twitter. Go follow KSO. You'll know about all this info that we're talking about before it is that it actually hits the air. So Rob Cassidy had this tweet about Shane Southwell earlier this week saying that he was in a gym. And Rob Cassidy, by the way, is now the national college basketball guy for Rivals.com. And he said someone told him that Shane Southwell is a rising star. There were no specifics beyond that, but what we can tack on to that is it's clear that Shane Southwell has done a lot of work to upgrade the talent level here at K-State. Marquise Noel, Ishmael Massoud, and then Maximus Edwards, all his responsibility, all guys from where he is originally from in New York. I am probably biased here because I love Shane Southwell, the guy. Great guy to talk to, great guy to hang out with. I loved him when he played here. I thought he had a fascinating story arc from his time at one, you know, once upon a time I watched him get kicked out of a practice on the team that eventually won a Big 12 championship, and he turned it around at a great attitude by the end of the year, and he was, Bill Self called him the most improved player in the league. Like, very cool. So I love him and I want to see him succeed. It seems to me like there is some objective evidence that he is on the path to becoming a very good assistant coach. Now, Derek, I know exactly what you're going to say. Like, people see a tweet like that and get too carried away with it. I'm certainly not going to do that. I just think for being a 29-year-old that's in, what, his third year as a legitimate Division I assistant, it seems like the early returns are he's providing K-State with something valuable that they definitely need on the staff, and that is a young guy that can relate to players and like go get legitimate talent and go get it out of the portal, like understand how the game works in 2021.
Yeah, I do think there are already – I've already seen some kind of get carried away with his prowess. Look, I think he is a rising star, but the furthest I would go with that kind of sentiment is to saying he's a rising star, like you said, and has the potential to be a great assistant coach. In terms of the X's and O's or scouting and stuff of that nature and actual the coaching, the real coaching part of it, I don't – know what his chops are like. We could probably find out fairly quickly. But in terms of what we do know that he is very well respected at Kansas State. We know that he relates to the players and is a good resource for them because of that. And we do know that he's turning into one of the more promising recruiters Bruce Weber's had on his staff. I think he's probably the best recruiter that he's had on a staff, at least since I've covered the team, which was back in 2017. They've had guys like Chester Frazier and Brad Korn in addition to who they have now. Brad Korn also was an underrated one as well. But I do think Shane Southwell, he's proving that he can recruit for Bruce and bring in some, I wouldn't say premier talent, but pretty good talent, even when there might not be a starting spot available, so to speak. He's not really like selling, hey, here's 35 minutes. When Bruce Weber has been able to do that, he's landed some really good players, whether that be Barry Brown, whether that be Dean Wade, whether that be Nigel Pack, Davion Bradford, Selton Miguel at that class. So when he's had a lot of playing time to sell, he's been able to find ways to accrue talent. When he doesn't have a whole lot of, you know, usage or playing time to sell, it's been a challenge, but Shane Southwell kind of broke through that ice despite not having all that playing time to sell. He was able to get to, you know, I wouldn't say a highly sought after, but two pretty sought after transfers that I think do make this team better.
Fair assessment. Like I think the one name I would throw out that's been on Bruce's staff before is Alvin Brooks, who just won a national championship at Baylor, who's been on Scott Drew's staff now it's probably going on 6 years at this point. But Alvin Brooks, I believe, was responsible. I mean, both Wesley Iwundu and Marcus Foster were from Texas. That's where all of Brooks' connections were. I believe he was responsible for both of those guys. Like, he definitely brought in some good talent here and was a very good recruiter, and it was disappointing when he left. I think we're talking about, like, a similar kind of level of talent that Shane Southwell has proven to be able to bring in so far. And, like, we'll see about Maximus Edwards. I mean, I don't know. His recruiting profile certainly is not going to really excite you with, like, Seton Hall being basically the best offer that's actually listed there, but they seem very high on him, and this will be – well, I think that's a fairly underrated talking point here about Shane to see, like, okay, how good is this kid that was pretty under-recruited, but – you speak very highly of. Is this going to be Chester Frazier and Good News Capagel, or is this going to be, you know, something much more impactful here? I think that's something I'll be very interested to watch too.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of those types of players that have come through Kansas State. Some of them did not amount to much, whether that be Good News Capagel. Trying to think of some other ones that were, you know, had pretty short stints in Manhattan as well. But there's also, I mean, Cam Stokes was kind of the same profile, and he ended up at K-State and had a pretty good career. I know he made people pull their hair out at times, but when you take his full sample size into account, I think you could say he had a very solid career in Manhattan.
Agreed, and that's a fair point. Also a Chester Frazier guy, so, you know, there's good and bad. I don't mean to just slam Chester, not that he really needs my approval now. I mean, he's still got a Division I job and is doing well. But, yeah, I'm high on the potential of Shane. I think it's fair for you to also come in and say, like, hey, and I would agree with it. Like, that doesn't mean Shane's a head coach in 3 years, but it means that Shane has the look of a bona fide, like, legitimate modern college basketball assistant and a guy that can really be around and make it in this business, which I think is really exciting because he, like, it was kind of risky. I mean, he was just so young and green in his career when Bruce Weber went and hired him, just having the 1 year at Robert Morris as, like, a full-time assistant. I think the early returns...
Basically 27 years old, too, at the time.
Yeah, so, I mean, the early returns here are he's got a future in this. I think that's really what it tells you. And by the way, the full tweet from Rob Cassidy was, I was in a gym in New York this weekend and had somebody extremely plugged in tell me they thought Shane is a rising star.
Yeah, I would say that. I think if you take that at face value, I think it's accurate. I think people wanting to kind of extract from that that he's going to be a head coach in 2 or 3 years or the next Kansas State coach, I think that's a leap that I wouldn't be willing to make. The leap that I'd be willing to make, or what I would, the statement that I'd be willing to make right now, is that he's proven that he belongs, and he's also proven that he's could has the potential to be a great recruiter, and that, I mean, he's not going to leave this industry. He's going to have a job on someone's staff for the duration, however long he wants to do it. He can name it because he's proven his value on the recruiting trail at a school like Kansas State, and that speaks volumes.
Absolutely. All right. DY and I have a common bond that we need to share with you all, and we'll make Derek answer the big question from yesterday coming up next. This is an exciting time on the show because we get to answer a major question that we had yesterday. Poll results are officially in. The debate Mitch and I were having, of course, what is the better fish? Is it trout or tilapia? 526 of you weighed in. And who do you think won, Mitch?
I think Trout won.
Trout did win 54-46, 54%. Yeah, 54% on Trout. And, of course, this was all because Derek should have an idea of this, because I made the joke in our group chat when Mike Trout got the golden sombrero and struck out 4 times the other night against the Royals that you might as well call him Mike Tilapia. So what do you think, DY? Better fish, Trout or Tilapia?
We talk about like eating, but just in general, I think trout has much more value than a tilapia.
Correct. And as I was alerted to by my friend Drew, tilapia is really just a name for like 100 different species of fish that are very bland and easy to pass off to people. So trout should be the answer here, everybody. Even though Mitch apparently had tilapia for lunch yesterday.
And today.
You heated up like leftover tilapia?
I mean, it's all gone in 3 days. It's meal prep.
You eat it 3 days in a row?
Oh. I mean, I
don't want to hear it from you guys.
I don't really like eating fish, so this just kind of grosses me out. But especially the idea of like reheated.
It tasted fine. It was fine. But I also make really good fish.
How did you prepare your tilapia?
I just put some lemon pepper on it. Put it in the oven for about 15 minutes. Tastes fine.
No thanks. DY, you on board with that?
No, that's how I would make like my salmon.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do that with salmon too.
But do you reheat salmon, Derek?
No, I would not.
Yeah, like fish, you're pretty much done. How about this food take? This is from Chris Beard. If you're not down with the Egg McMuffin, you're not a truth teller. Fact or fiction?
Fiction. I think McDonald's breakfast is overrated.
Oh, you're killing me. I love
Chick-fil-A breakfast is where it's at.
I like McDonald's breakfast an awful lot, and I like the Egg McMuffin an awful lot. I also like the show Billions a lot, and I was very happy to see, DY, that you have now got on that train, because I spent basically like January through, it took me a while, January through probably March? Mid-March, I just finished the 5th season, wherever they're at right now in Billions. And
I'm halfway through season 4.
Okay, yeah, like it's a lot of TV to watch. That's the thing. Like it's, you know, they're like hour-long episodes, but it is so good, man. That is a drama that is very, very well done.
Favorite character?
Well, I was laughing because you seemed to really like Dollar Bill, and I was like, oh, okay.
I like Dollar Bill.
That's an interesting choice. It's hard not to say Chuck. Now, actually, I'll tell you this. Big Wendy fan here. Big Wendy fan.
What about Wags? Wags is awesome.
Wags is great. But Wendy, whew, man, I'm a fan.
She's a fox.
She is. And like, she means business. She knows exactly what she's doing. She can just like read your mind and get right in there and know exactly what it is that you're thinking and like what you need.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, Wendy.
I don't like Taylor Mason. I don't like That's probably my least favorite character. I'm indifferent on Wendy. Chuck is the one that's kind of I've evolved on. Like at the beginning, like season one, you don't want to like him, but then you, a few seasons in, you're like, this dude's ruthless.
Yeah, well, they all are. Like that's, the show is basically like how, you know, all these people are doing shady things to everybody at high levels with all this money, and like how much can you handle, and how much are you going to take that into account as to like whether or not you like the person? Like, that's the fascinating dynamic of it. But yes, big Chuck fan. Chuck and Wendy, man, power couple, America's power couple. All right, we're running out of time here. DY, good to talk to you. We'll do it again soon.
Absolutely.
Everybody go watch Billions, and we'll talk some more K-State hoops next.